325 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN with Derek Johnson. I'm Nick Schwert. Appreciate you hanging out with us. We'll talk to Matt Galloway of the Topeka Capital Journal coming up at the top of the 4 o'clock hour. But right now, let's talk to the voice of the Jayhawks, Brian Haney. Brian, the non-con portion of KU's schedule now in the rearview mirror. They open up Big 12 play against West Virginia tomorrow. I know you've got to spend some time around these players and some of these coaches. What is the mindset of this team entering conference play?
Well, I think they're determined to right the wrongs of the last couple of weeks and probably a little bit frustrated. I wouldn't use the term discouraged just yet, but they're upset that they didn't get a win the last couple of weeks and realize that got to start better than what we've seen. Obviously, it was the second quarter versus Central Michigan and the first quarter versus Ohio, but this is not a team, especially now that we get into the teeth of the schedule, that can spot another team a 3 or 4 score lead and expect to climb out of it. Now, I love our quick strike offensive attack, and Doug Meacham and Peyton Bender are going to get better by the week in terms of the plays they're calling and the plays they're executing and all of that. And it was really great to see maybe the best ground attack we've seen in the last couple of seasons versus Ohio with Khalil Herbert going nuts for 137 yards. But I don't care who you're up against over these last 9 games. You can't dig a hole that deep and expect to climb out of it and win a game. So I think an important key to tomorrow, as it is any week, it's imperative to get off to a better start. And that doesn't mean that you have to jump out to a huge lead or anything, but just match the Mountaineers blow for blow, punch for punch early on. This is a high-powered offensive attack coming in. Will Greer's number 8 nationally in total offense. They're running back and their receiver, Crawford and Seals, are right now number 2 nationally in receiving and rushing touchdowns, respectively. They're going to put points on the board. And I just think for Kansas to stay in this game confidence-wise, need to get a couple of stops early, need to complete a couple of drives early with 7, not 3. And if that's the case, I think you assert yourselves as a team that's going to be there for the full 4 quarters and have a chance to possibly upset the Mountaineers, who are in the top 25 to open the year. If you dig another big hole, man, that's going to be tough odds against a team that many feel is upper half of the Big 12 and one that could compete to win 8 games this year.
And that's something that David Beatty talked about earlier in this week, digging those big holes going into halftime, facing those big deficits. And maybe this is easier said than done, but at least offensively speaking, based off what we've seen through 3 games, at least to me, it does look like a unit that's just a few plays or a few mistakes here and there from putting together a really solid, complete game offensively.
Yeah, I think so. And one thing that really frustrated the coaching staff, and I realize it might sound like crying over spilt milk a week later when you lose by 2 scores, but on that first drive of the game, if you'll recall, KU got to midfield and then it stalled out, and there was a blatant miscall on what would have been an offsides penalty that would have set up a first down inside Ohio territory. And again, at one point they were down by 25. So far be it for me to say those 5 yards are going to make up for ultimately a 12-point loss. But, man, it's all about time, score, confidence, and momentum. And if they could have kept that drive going, I'm not playing the victim card here at all. The offense stalled out plenty of other times. The defense gave up plenty of scoring drives. But the point is, I do think things snowball positively for you if you can get off to a better start and complete some of these drives. And that was one thing. I know the coaching staff went back and filed a complaint about that blatant missed call. And so, again, we're not making more out of 5 yards than we need to, but it's so important when you're the underdog. And let's call it like it is. They're probably going to be the underdog every game going forward, with maybe the exception of Baylor. Man, you got to take your chances when you get them, and you got to capitalize, and you got to pop the other team in the mouth early and show them that you're not going to go quietly into the night. And so I think this Kansas club has been close to being much better than what we've seen, and what we've seen hasn't been that bad, quite frankly. 30 points in a lot of weeks would win for you, like we saw last week, but it took second and fourth quarter heroics to get to that total after the first and third quarters were pretty stagnant. And that's where you got to play a cleaner game, and you got to finish drives more so than what we've seen. And I think Peyton Bender, his ability to stay in the game through some adversity last week when, quite frankly, after that third quarter interception, I would not have been surprised at all if Carter Stanley got the next series. But credit David Beatty. He stuck with his guy. Kansas was much better down the stretch. So too was Bender. He's developing rapport with more than just the Steven Sims, Ben Johnson type targets. I think Chase Harrell is going to be a guy that catches 6 or 7 touchdowns this year. And I think we're seeing guys like Evan Fairs emerge, and Jeremiah Booker. And so I thought it was really a growing moment for Kansas's confidence and the rapport of Bender and his receivers to fight through some of that, finish a fourth quarter in which he outscored Ohio 16-3. And even though it didn't result in a win, you got a little bit of momentum there, the way you closed out the game, hopefully spills over into something better going into league play.
And we've got the voice of the Jayhawks, Brian Haney, here with us on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. And this may seem like making something out of nothing, but you talk about Bender and having your guy there and knowing on a week-by-week basis that he is going to be that quarterback. And I know they want to get some packages out there for Carter Stanley and get him involved with the offense, but just having that luxury, which is something that KU simply has not had over the last couple of years, week by week, knowing you've got a quarterback who can sling it and he's going to be your guy, like that's a huge boon for this team. It's something that they haven't had in a couple of years, and I guess we'll continue to see if that's going to pay dividends down the road into Big 12 play. But through three games, like there's not much to criticize in terms of the fact that, okay, you've got a quarterback, you finally got some stability at that position.
Yeah, and I think that it's only going to get better with Peyton. He's going to figure out how to take what's in front of him if all receiving options are sealed off, and taking what's in front of him means just tucking and running for 4 yards straight forward. He's going to figure that out and be better. He's not going to be Michael Vick. He's not going to be Todd Reason in terms of escapability and all that, but I think that will make him a more complete player and make this offense more sustainable on its drives and ultimately more potent in scoring more points. But what we have seen that you like, I think, is something you can really get behind and get excited about. We talked last week about how on occasion he'll have some erratic throws. And Doug Meacham's analogy, which I still kind of chuckle about, but I understand where he's coming from. He said, you know, Peyton, these first few weeks, he'll be in a layup line, basketball term, okay? And he hits 9 layups in a row, and then on the 10th layup, it goes over the backboard. And, you know, 1 out of every 10 throws is just way off the mark. He's going to sharpen that up. He knows he has to. And the coaching staff's working with him to figure out, is it a situation with his footwork? Is it something else that's leading to this? You know, in this case, in Ohio, he threw a ball 4 or 5 feet behind Steven Sims that got tipped up into the air. I think in that instance, it was just timing. He just missed the mark. But he's going to get better. He's going to run more. But what we've seen to this point, and what I would probably grade a B, B minus in his first three games, has been promising. And there'll be days this season where he has an A. And to this point, to have 343 passing yards per game, to make some throws downfield that I'm not sure anybody else on the roster could make, I like what I see. He's not setting the world on fire by any means, but we didn't expect him to 3 games in. But you expect him to grow and get better consistently. I think that's what we're seeing. Having said that, as much as I agree with everything you said, and I love the continuity of having that quarterback who's clearly your QB1, don't be surprised if there's more instances of Carter Stanley this week. And it has nothing to do with any lost confidence in Peyton Bender. They planned a lot more for Carter last week. But when you fall down by 18, it changes a lot of your game plan. You have to throw a lot of that stuff out. So don't be surprised if number 9's in there more than what you saw in week 3. And that doesn't mean anything about their confidence in Peyton Bender. He's still absolutely QB1. But I think they like the change of pace that Carter could bring to the table. And I think hopefully this will turn into a situation where both guys serve Kansas well.
Defensively speaking, I know that there were some question marks with the secondary heading into the season, and I'm sure there are still plenty around that aspect of the team heading into conference play. Just how tough of a task do they have ahead of them trying to right the ship while coupling that with the fact that the competition's only going to increase from here on out?
Well, I'm concerned because the speed factor you're about to see from West Virginia is on a different level than what they saw these last 2 weeks against a couple of the really good MAC teams that are bowl schools for sure. I think we have very capable talent that in time will be much better than what it's been. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a secondary that has 2 true sophomores and 2 junior college signees that are playing in their 3rd and 4th games, you know, at the Big 12 conference caliber level. First ever head-to-head Big 12 league game. That's a lot of green. That's a lot of youth. And now they're going to go up against a lot of speed. And there's 3 different players that on any given week could step up and lead them. And they have a different type of speed factor than I think Kansas has seen so far. Gary Jennings is one of the first guys you have to look at. He had 189 yards versus Virginia Tech. 2 100-yard games already right now. I mean, he's averaging over 120 a game, which is 13th nationally. Sills, the kid that was a 13-year-old commit to the USC football program, Lane Kiffin, he's number two in the country in receiving touchdowns right now, a former quarterback converted receiver. And then they've got Kevin White's brother on this team, too, and you know, he's no slouch. He's not a top 10 pick like his brother was with the Bears, but I think clearly he's a guy that is a red zone threat. He scored in back-to-back weeks, and he can lead them on any given day. He's already got 14 receptions on the season. And so for a secondary that certainly has been challenged over the first 3 weeks against a couple of good MAC schools that you know, clearly will both be bowl programs this year, this is on a whole different level, though, in terms of speed factor and Greer's ability to spread the ball around. He's averaging 342 yards passing per game. So it's going to be a stiff test for sure. And as we've said time and time again, we sound like a broken record. The best thing for Hassan Defense and Shaq Taylor and Tornadin and Lee and all the guys back there is if Dorrance and Daniel and J.J. and Josh can get to the quarterback, rattle his cage, shorten his time back there, force him to throw off his back foot, deflect some passes, knock him to the ground 5 or 6 times. If he has the time to sit back there and just slice and dice and pick apart the Kansas secondary, it's going to be a long day. So it's got to come up front, and maybe this week more so than any we've seen to this point this season.
In the case of Dorrance Armstrong, Daniel Wise, those guys, I know their impact goes deeper than the box score and just how many TFLs or sacks that they're picking up on a week-by-week basis. And in hearing from Dorrance Armstrong earlier this week, he still wants to start doing that. Like, that's something that he clearly is making putting an emphasis on, is starting to rack up some sacks, knowing the impact he can have if he can disrupt the quarterback. But how much of that goes hand in hand with what the secondary is able to do and how much the guys up front are able to get after the quarterback?
Well, you're right. I mean, they need to stay with their guys, and whether it's man coverage or if they're playing cover four, they can't have wide open seams to throw the ball into that makes for a quick read, easy decision. I think in week two, Central Michigan quarterback Shane Morris did a great job of getting the ball out of his hands fast, and some of that was set up by the routes they were running and some of those rub plays that got guys wide open, and some of it was he's a 23-year-old dude that makes quick decisions, and he's tall, and it's hard to get to him before the ball's out of there. I think Greer's a similar guy in terms of good decision-making and has decisive actions back there that get it out hot. So Kansas has to get to him quicker, but you're right, the secondary could help with that too. I think that part of the problem versus Ohio, I saw Dorrance slipping a ton. You noticed it on the kick returns, especially when a guy has a ball in his hands. You don't notice it so much on defense unless you go back and look at the film and you see a guy just losing his footing and falling down. And you know, Dorrance got nicked up late in the game. That was a factor too, I'm sure. But whether it's Daniel, Dorrance, JJ, whoever, they got to get a push up front. And I think they can. You know, the offensive line for West Virginia has some talented guys on it, but it's not overwhelming. And I think if you're going to play to your advantage and have this truly be the talking point that we, you know, hinge our hopes on week in and week out, you got to start to assert your will a little bit more with that defensive front. And hopefully that'll come in the form of a disruptive day by Dorrance and Daniel. And, you know, Wise, by the way, is off to a great start. He's got 6 tackles for losses already in 3 games. He had 10 all of last season. I thought J.J. Holmes was their best defensive lineman in week 3. So we are seeing some good things. And I think the thing that was most encouraging to me in week 3 was that, and I'm sure you noticed this too, Nick, there were probably 4 or 5 plays where Kansas had him dead to rights, had a guy almost wrapped up and taken down. They were in position. They got to their spot. They were assignment sound, but they just couldn't quite finish the deal. And in a couple of instances, there wound up being a face mask, or I hated the play that sustained the drive for Ohio because Daniel was in position for a big loss, a drive halter, and the quarterback just ducks at the last second, and instead of his arm going around the shoulder pads, it goes into his face and in the helmet area, as a personal foul, 15-yard penalty, fresh set of downs. There were several instances where they coulda, shoulda, woulda. And I know we don't deal on what ifs. We deal with what is. And they got to do a better job finishing those plays and not just being close, because close doesn't count in the win column. But would you agree they were in position to make those plays more so than they were in the Central Michigan game? That, to me, is progress. Now you got to close the deal and make those plays. Get off the field with a 3 and out or 2. force them to punt more than what we've seen because you finish the tackle, you get to the man. I think they're on their way to being better at that, but at the same time they're getting better, Nick, so too is the competition. So we'll see if that levels off here in week four.
KU and West Virginia opening up Big 12 play tomorrow inside Memorial Stadium. Kickoff at 11 right here on KLWN. B. Haney on the call. Appreciate the time as always, man, and best of luck on the call tomorrow.
Hey, it's going to be an exciting weekend to be a Jayhawk in more ways than one. I'm glad you're going to be in the booth with us, Nick. Thanks for having me on. Thanks to my friends at Crystal K9. They take care of my best buddy, Griffey, every time I'm out on the road. They do doggy daycare and pet obedience training. And a shout-out to our friends at Lawrence Memorial Hospital. We're about T-minus 4 weeks away from Rock the Block, one of their biggest annual fundraisers. Been working with Tiffany Hall and the company on that. So excited to have LMH on board with everything we're doing here on KLWN as well.
Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, that is Brian Haney. I am Nick Schwartz. This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Up next, some NFL whip around. The Zeke Elliott saga continues.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwartz on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Four o'clock hour here, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We'll have another Zaxby's giveaway for you coming up later on in the show. Matt Galloway joining us in studio for the 4 o'clock hour. Movie review, Coming to America, coming up here in just about 40 minutes or so. But we got to talk some KU, I guess. And this weekend, tomorrow, I don't think many people are expecting KU to go and beat West Virginia after seeing what West Virginia's done offensively and seeing the struggles that KU's had, especially in the secondary over the first 3 weeks. But you got a bye week next week, and it just happens to be the same week that late night starts. So that's officially the start of Kansas basketball season. And I'm sure you saw the tweets and the Facebook posts last week of about halftime of that game. When's basketball season start? When's late night again? Which is the oldest joke in the book for Kansas football fans. But if they can't keep it close tomorrow, you do kind of wonder how many people are going to check out for the rest of the season.
You know, I almost wonder at this point how many people already have checked out at this point in the season. I would also be remiss if I didn't wish you a happy Scott Chasen Day, International Scott Chasen Day.
What do you mean?
It is his, I believe it's his 17th birthday, so I want to just offer my congrats to him and all his family.
One more year, he can buy cigarettes and nudie magazines.
Yeah, I think this is the last year he can officially go to Chuck E. Cheese.
So that's why you've been going to all those movies with him, because he needed an adult chaperone to get to those R-rated films.
Yeah, I haven't actually been to a movie with him in a long time, but yeah.
Do you miss those days?
Not really, no. No, because we never agreed on the movies, and it would always anger me.
He'd always shame
deeply.
You. He'd shame you for your opinions.
Right.
See, we bring you on here to give you, you know, the forum to let your opinions develop and grow and mature, and you nurture them and we nurture you, and he just, you know, tries to throw dirt on you.
Tear me down and belittle my opinions. Yeah. No,
not
it's,
us.
It's an awful
not
dynamic.
Not on RCST, man.
No, not really. I think the conversation that we've kind of just started to trail off already kind of shows maybe the interest level in this football game coming ahead on Saturday. And I'm not saying that to belittle or, you know, disparage the football team in any way. I think that there's still a lot to be optimistic about with the football program and a lot to look forward to. I just think this is my personal feeling, having watched social media during that game at Ohio, having watched all the fans just completely just leave during the second quarter, even not even waiting until halftime, but during the second quarter of Central Michigan, I almost feel like, and I said this to you off the air, I almost feel like there's less interest in this particular football season in a vacuum than there was the last season and maybe even the season before, because I think fans might feel a bit snake bitten. I don't know how you feel about that. I just see nobody talking about it. Nobody on social media really tweeting about it or posting things like that. They'll always have the diehards, like the fan I wrote about a couple weeks ago after the Central Michigan game. But I think that if you're asking me if basketball season's begun, regardless of football, I think basketball season is a 24/7, 365 proposition at Kansas.
Yeah, and it's unique to Kansas and a handful of other schools that have that sort of, you can call it what you want. You can call it a dilemma. You can call it a boon, because for basketball fans, they're excited about basketball season, regardless of what the football team's doing. But to your point, I don't know. I have always believed that you can't tell fans how to be fans. You can't try to tell them how to react. They're going to react one way or the other, and you can convince one or two guys, but the fan base is going to do what they want to do. And I've always thought that the biggest thing that any team ever wants from their fan base is loyalty. And loyalty is a kind of a mirage, because loyalty is going to be there as long as you are good. And you can preach patience as much as you want to, but all patience is okay, well, we'll check back in when you're good.
Well, I mean, look at Alabama before Nick Saban got there. Look at K-State during the Ron Prince years. Look at Mizzou now, at the amount of people that fled the stadium during the Purdue game. I don't think there's any fan base in the country that, when you know stuff hits the fan, is truly loyal to the bone. I think every fan base will have hardcore loyal fans, but I mean, KU starts winning again, Memorial Stadium's going to get filled up. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I do. And you used the word snake bitten, and I think that that's appropriate, but only to an extent, because of the fact that, and I've taken responsibility for this, not to like be arrogant and say I am single-handedly swaying the opinions of the fan, but all off season long, I was kind of buying into what I was seeing and what I was hearing, that this team was going to be better, they were going to make a huge improvement, and they have. And the biggest mistake I made was underestimating just how inexperienced and youthful that secondary is. Mm-hmm. You can't replace experience. The secondary from a season ago was not world beaters, but they had three seniors starting in it. And this year you got three guys starting in it who had zero career starts coming into this season. And the most experienced player in that secondary is a guy who should be a true freshman this year in Mike Lee. So that, I mean, there are improvements across the board, but I think the inexperience in that secondary has kind of counteracted a lot of the benefits that we were hoping to see and that we have seen coming into this year.
And I think a lot of KU fans would have looked at it in three units and thought, all right, well, the defensive line, you and I talked about it, perhaps being the deepest unit on the team going into the season. The linebackers, you've got Joe Dineen coming back, you've got Keith Lonaker, you've got a lot of depth there. A lot of people thought that going into last season was their deepest unit. They're getting some people back this week too, but I think that people thought those two units would, you know, elevate the young, inexperienced secondary. And while you and I kind of talked about this, we thought that there would be issues with the secondary. I don't think we thought that they would be this bad, and it has dragged the entire defense down. I do think that they did some better things against Ohio, but Ohio's primarily a running team. But again, you have people, guys like Joe Dineen, like I mentioned, who shouldered the blame for the loss against Ohio and said that, you know, I missed a ton of tackles. This one's on me. Daniel Wise, a guy that you wouldn't expect, he missed a couple tackles. He got a costly personal foul in that game on a fluky situation where he ripped off a guy's helmet. So, you know, I think that it's a matter of that secondary has not risen to the other two levels. And I think that the other two have kind of like fallen down a bit. But I mean, even the offense has had its issues. I mean, the running game was nothing special the first two games.
But the offense
Peyton
has been
Bender
good
has
enough.
Made some. It's been good enough. I will agree with that. I wrote about the offense on Saturday, wrote about the defense on Sunday. If you were to ask me why is KU 1-2, it's the defense. It's defense 1A and defense 1B. But Peyton Bender has to, you know, increase his accuracy on the short range stuff. He's got to make better decisions. You know, we talked to Doug Meacham yesterday, and he explained that infamous play that went viral where all the offensive linemen cut block. That was supposed to be a quick release for Peyton Bender. I think that's obvious at this point. And maybe it's a situation where Meacham thought he tried to do too much. He might have thought there was an opening where if he just held it just a little bit longer with the amount of guys coming up, he could have had a longer completion, got a little greedy maybe. So the offense has... But any other year since, I would say, 2009, you would take this offense. But it's not been good enough to overcompensate for the defensive struggles. And I think the turning point on Saturday was the turnover that Peyton Bender had.
He's Matt Galloway joining us here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWM. And I understand the frustrations and the disappointment, and I went on a mini rant on this on Saturday. But I can't for a second understand that just because, and I'm not trying to diminish like your disappointment or that you should be less disappointed or less frustrated, but the logic that I saw getting spewed out there on Saturday was, okay, well, we just lost to two straight MAC opponents where we really weren't in it late in the game. I thought we'd be better than this at this point. This isn't working. And that's a really, really, really big leap to make from I'm disappointed to this isn't working, because there are improvements being made. And if you want to try and denigrate those by saying, well, the improvements are pretty minuscule compared to where we thought we'd be at this point, just because you're scoring a few more points or you're having a little bit more success in the passing game, the results are the same. And this isn't working. I thought we'd be farther than this. And my reaction is do not do this to yourselves, because fans are the people who make changes in organizations, in athletic departments. If you clamor enough, you will get what you want. And I really hope those voices don't become louder and louder, because you're setting yourself up for not just failure this year, but another decade of failure if you are ready to throw in the towel. There are improvements being made. We knew this was going to be a difficult task for Beatty to turn this program around. Don't throw in the towel before I think the answers are definitive, because so far, I think it doesn't matter whether I think that they have been, they're behind schedule or ahead of schedule. I thought this was a five-year job. I'm not going to judge it two years and three games in.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans thought whenever David Beatty was hired, it was at least a four-year job, maybe a five-year job. And I think that fans should probably readjust their expectations to where they were when David Beatty was signed, and not to where they were this offseason, coming off the victory against Texas, coming off the number of recruits that they got to verbally commit, coming off of the locker room upgrades and all the other things that they've done from a facilities standpoint, and all the other buzz that's around the program and getting Doug Meacham in and all of that stuff that built to so much hype. I still think, though, it probably isn't too much to have asked for competitiveness and not to fall into 18-point holes in such early fashion in both of these games.
But if you break it down, right, if you say, okay, well, I want it to be more competitive, which, of course, who doesn't, right? Like, is it too much to ask for you guys to be competitive against a MAC opponent? No, it's not.
Yeah.
But if you break it down and say, okay, why weren't they competitive on Saturday? Well, it's because they had some costly turnover there right after getting a pick and maybe having some momentum. The defense just couldn't stop that Ohio attack. And you point that out and you say, okay, well, why couldn't they do those things? Well, it's because you have a quarterback who's in his third game of being your guy in this system, and you have a secondary who is really, really, really inexperienced, and most of these guys are in their, third start of their Division I career. Okay, now you take another step forward. Okay, well, why is the secondary full of young guys? Well, because this is David Beatty's second full recruiting class, and the recruits that people have fawned over and said, okay, these guys are going to be really good, these guys have high upside. Well, the upside, it's called upside for a reason, because they're not there yet, because they have potential, but it's going to take some time to reach it. There's a reason why they're freshmen starting in the secondary, because Charlie Weiss didn't leave David Beatty much to work with, and he has had to build this thing essentially from the ground up. That's going to take time, and maybe for us to put these lofty expectations, which you could argue are three or four wins lofty, not for most teams, but from where this team is coming from, maybe they were.
Yeah, and I mean, with Clint Bowen's system, he's talked about the complexity of it. You're thrown right into the fire, and it's not going to change in Big 12 play when you go up against Baker Mayfield, you go up against Oklahoma State, you go up against Texas Tech. I think that this is something that's going to be a season-long issue, but, you know, Clint Bowen's talked about sometimes you take your lumps, and I think a lot of KU fans just thought that they might be beyond the point of taking those lumps, even though it is really just one specific unit at this point.
He's Matt Galloway. I'm Nick Schwartz. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We will get to Matt's movie review coming up at 4:45. Up next, at your Friday news break.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwartz on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
We got a Zaxby's giveaway coming your way in about 10 minutes from right now. Brandon McAnderson joins us at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. I'm Nick Schwartz with Derek Johnson, Matt Galloway of the Topeka Capital Journal joining us in studio. And right now, it's time for your weekly movie review with Matt Galloway.
Hey!
Thank you, musician. On today's docket for your weekly movie review, Coming to America, starring Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, and they play just about every character in that movie. And with that, I will send it over to our featured reviewer. That is Matt Galloway of the Topeka Capital Journal. Matt, can you give me a 5-word synopsis of Coming to America?
African prince comes to America.
Couldn't you have just done it in 3 words, Coming to America?
Well, I wanted to use the, you know, as a writer, as a scribe, you have to use every word that you can.
Yeah, you're such a pro's pro.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, Arsenio Hall, I had no idea he was in this movie, and I actually didn't know he really acted. I just knew
what
him from
What did
you
think he did?
I thought he did his talk show.
He was a comedian.
Well, he was a comedian, and he did his talk show. I didn't know he was in movies, but he was actually pretty good.
So you didn't know he was in the movie while you were watching it?
Or? No, I knew he was in the movie when I was watching it. What I didn't know was that they were playing all these different characters.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm an idiot, but until they got to the end and they showed all the people that they were attributed to,
right,
I didn't realize that Eddie Murphy played, you know, this, I guess, this cheesy band leader. And I had no idea that he played this old white Jewish man who was arguing, kind of just having these back and forth conversations about boxing with these black barbers. And I didn't know that Eddie Murphy was some of the black barbers too. Maybe I should have noticed that, but I think maybe it was just a good job by Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall to kind of...
Is that a little arrogant? Because Eddie Murphy does that in like every movie he plays.
But this is the first one he actually did, though.
But he did it in all of the Nutty Professor movies. Yeah. He has to play the whole family. Like Mike Myers. Mike Myers did the same thing in Austin Powers. Have you seen Austin Powers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He was Dr. Evil.
I'm always looking for new movies to throw on the wheel.
Okay.
All right. So they play every movie. Yeah. They play basically every character.
So basically, he's an African prince who's resisting his parents' attempts at an arranged marriage. He agrees to go
James,
40 days.
What's the guy's name?
James Earl Jones.
Gosh,
and I want to say, awesome. So he played
Always
King.
Sounds like he's...
He's great.
Deep on,
I mean,
like
he has
eight
the
cups
best
of coffee and
voice.
Nine cigarettes.
Some people will say Morgan Freeman. I think James Earl Jones has the best voice ever.
It's the coffee voice. It's like he just finished 10 cups of coffee.
So most people know James Earl Jones as Darth Vader, right? That's the
old man from Sandlot.
Yeah. I grew up as part of...
Have you seen Sandlot?
No.
Okay.
That's why I just ignored it and
moved
on.
Sounded like a comment from somebody who hadn't seen it.
That's why I just ignored it and moved on.
Yeah, totally.
But I know him... grew up as part of a generation that knows him most as Mufasa.
That's right.
So, as Lion King. So, watching him walk
Thanks
around
for
this
clarification.
Movie. Well, you know, some listeners might not know. It's kind of an indie movie.
Yeah, right. Underground.
You know, watching him walk around with like a skinned lion was a little bit jarring to me, using the Mufasa voice, because he has the same voice in every film. That was a little bit of a shock to the system for me. But basically, that he agrees with Eddie Murphy, okay, we're going to give you 40 days to go and quote sow your oats in America, and then you can come back and partake in this arranged marriage. He goes to America, he picks New York, he flips a coin, and he picks Queens because he wants to find his queen.
Right.
So he goes over there with Simi, who is a servant played by Arsenio Hall, and a bunch of hijinks ensue as he tries to find love and in Queens, New York. And that's basically the longer synopsis of it. But so I thought that Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy had great chemistry. I thought they both played their roles well. I thought a lot
I'm learning that on-screen chemistry is a big factor in your ratings.
Yeah, because I mean, there have been some where I thought that the people didn't have very good chemistry. But I mean, obviously, we haven't put very many bad movies on here, so I'm not going to find films with
the
people
worst
who are kind of...
chemistry would clearly be Open Water between the husband
and
the wife.
Oh, horrible! But I mean, that was horrible. Everything.
Okay.
I mean,
fair enough.
It was just grating. It was like nails on a chalkboard hearing them whine and complain about being eaten by sharks. But I just, you know, Roger Ebert said about this movie that it was kind of lethargic and lacked energy for an Eddie Murphy movie. It was a romantic comedy. It was the first time he tried to go out on that limb. And I thought he did well. But he thought that of the two lead male characters, he thought they're both talented guys. Give him a screenplay. He thought it was very cookie cutter. Something that had been done a million times.
I don't like that you are checking with other reviewers.
Oh, that was like at the end of my notes.
Okay.
So that's not going to play. But I do agree with what he said. I thought this was kind of cliche. I mean, I hadn't... The whole... It's basically the story of Romeo and Juliet almost near the end. The two families both... And I like the twist of, you know, the female that he's pursuing in this, Lisa, is also in the American version, I guess, of an arranged marriage with a rich, arrogant man. But to me, it just, I didn't laugh hard enough at the jokes. I don't think the jokes landed well enough with me to make up for the fact that it was kind of a cookie cutter screenplay.
I agree. I watched it last night, and I've seen this movie probably 6 or 7 times, and the biggest thing that stood out to me last night was it's too long. It's almost 2 hours long. And if you're not going, if you're going to be a comedy, generally an hour and a half, hour 45 is pretty good for a comedy. But if you're going to go longer than that, you need to be like, it needs to be like gut busting, uproariously hilarious. And this movie is not that.
And there were some funny bits. I mean, like whenever they first arrive in America and Eddie Murphy's like, we don't want anybody to know that we're African royalty here, so just keep a low profile. And they have on like their full
right?
Royal garb, and they have people walking with a million suitcases behind them, and he just walks in front of a taxi and gets an F-bomb, and then he starts using the F-bomb throughout the film as just kind of, because he just thinks it's a colloquialism, I guess. Of
I think the American barbershop culture. Scenes are the best part of the movie.
They didn't really hit with me.
No?
No.
Just constantly arguing about Cassius Clay. His mama calls him Cassius. I'm going to call him Cassius.
Yeah.
I like that stuff. Okay, so I think that this movie, I think it's going to get in a bad review from you. I think that's where
we're
headed.
Well, what would you
right
consider
here.
Bad? Because I started at 5. Do you think I liked it more than Dazed and Confused? Or
I think it's in that range.
Yeah.
I wrote down for my prediction for your review, which is becoming perhaps the star of the show. I wrote down initially I thought you were going to give this 7.25. Mm-hmm. But after hearing your review, I think I'm going to have to knock it down to a 6.25.
Okay. Well, I will give it a 6.75.
Just to buck.
No,
to not
that's
be,
what I had.
Okay.
Because I thought it was better than the films I gave a 6.5.
Do you have it above Sicario and Usual Suspects, which were your 6.5s?
Yeah. Now, where did I have...
See, that okay.
Where
that,
did I have Dazed and Confused?
I have a problem.
5.5.
I have a problem. Okay. I have a big problem.
What's that? Usual Suspects. You are always going to hate
no,
that.
No. My biggest problem with your rating so far, my biggest problem with every rating you've given is Sicario. Okay. I think it is egregious that you would that you would put Coming to America over Sicario, that you would give Sicario a 6.5.
I'd have to go back and listen. I've watched so many films at this point that I can't remember possibly why I would have given that film that rating.
But I've watched 10 times as
right?
many films as you.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm a busy man with a lot of things going on, and sometimes I...
Oh, please.
But, you know, I did like the... I have to mention the Samuel L. Jackson cameo.
Right.
That was great. Now, was it a cameo at that point? Because I don't know what his star level
was. Yes, I think
point.
It was a cameo okay. for him. Well...
What were his big films before that?
I don't know.
It came out in June of 88, which was less than 2 months before my birthday, so... When I was born, when
cool.
I came into this, when I came to America, truly. So it was the closest film. And also, I want to also mention, I think this was the quickest we've ever had a topless scene in a film.
Yeah, very early.
I think Open Water came close, and there was another film, you might have the list in front of you, Derek, if you can remember, that had almost instantly a topless scene that you told me about in advance, but I don't remember which one
it
was.
Yeah, Coming to America, he is credited as the hold-up man. I don't think he had been acting since 1972, but no big-time roles. So he didn't really get his big breakthrough until Goodfellas in 1990, and then came Jungle Fever, then came Juice, then came Jurassic Park. So yeah, he was great.
He was, again, just screaming Samuel L. Jackson, and he came across like... You know, for me, that Matt Damon moment in Interstellar where it's like you don't expect to see this person at this time. He just came in and stole the scene. So that was a good cameo. But again, this movie was 2 hours, and I don't know what you thought about it, but I felt like they had a difficult time. They rushed the ending, I thought, which if you have 2 hours, there's no reason to do that.
Hey, your review. I'm not judging. Good job, I guess.
No,
but
you hate what
no,
I did with Sicario.
No, it's appropriately, yeah, it's because Sicario is put at a 6.5, it makes me have qualms with pretty much anything you rate around Sicario. Nonetheless, we got a new movie. We took off, Coming to America was a comedy. We put a new comedy on, Pineapple Express. Go ahead and give it a spin. You're really getting the form after 3 or 4 months now. You're really starting to get the form of the wheel spin down pat here. Another powerful spin with a lot of vigor and gusto here. Some salt and vinegar in that spin. Here we go. Old School, another comedy. Once again, we are on a comedy train right now, but I'm okay with it because I think you're going to enjoy this one.
I've heard good things.
Will Ferrell, Luke Wilson, the less attractive and less successful of the Wilson brothers, and Vince Vaughn.
So, this might be my favorite comedy.
I think it's certainly up there for me. So there you go. That's your movie for next week. He's Matt Galloway. That's his review. He's sticking to it. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
785-843-1321. Give me a call right now. Fifth caller is going to receive 2 free meal coupons to Zaxby's here in Lawrence. They use real chicken tenderloins, not those water-cut chicken breasts that everybody else is using. It's the best selection. It's the best quality that you're going to find for chicken around these parts. 785-843-1321 is the phone number for free meal coupons to Zaxby's. Indescribably good. Brandon McAnderson joins us next. New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. 5 o'clock hour is here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Let's talk some KU football. Brandon McAnderson, former Kansas running back, Orange Bowl champion, joins us now on the show. Through 3 non-con games, KU loses 2 in a row, both to MAC opponents, Ohio and Central Michigan. But Brandon, you and I have talked about this a little bit off the air. They're losing, but it doesn't seem like they're losing in the same matter or manner in which they have in years past, which was they just looked overmatched on the field. That doesn't necessarily look what it's been like over the past 2 weeks. What do you kind of chalk that up to?
I'm not certain. It looks like in the last 2 games specifically, they have been grossly out-executed, but they don't look like a team that's overmatched. To me, at times, they look like a team that's used to losing. And I think that is a bigger factor than physical. Because in the past couple years, they would lose games, but you could look at Kansas and see that these guys weren't Big 12 players. Now when I look at them physically and athletically, I think they are there. They are a lot closer than they were before. They are right on the cusp of being that physically. But from an execution standpoint, it hasn't been there for the first few weeks. And they've kind of played in spurts where they've had success, where you've seen what they are capable of doing. It just hasn't been consistent enough. But you can't tell me that a Joe Denean physically doesn't match up with other linebackers in this conference. Obviously Armstrong does. Obviously Wise does. Obviously Mike Lee does. So this is not a team that looks inferior to me. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's a little bit harder to digest for those reasons.
And I agree with you. They, as far as the Big 12 caliber talent is concerned, like year one of David Beatty, the roster was littered with guys, to be quite frank, who just didn't belong playing or starting for a Big 12 team. Now you do have those sorts of guys, and I know this is an impossible question for you to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyways. But like, what's the next step? Like, how do you get over that hump to the point of, okay, you've got the talent now, maybe not a call all across the roster from top to bottom, but you've got enough to compete. How do you get to the point where you are competing on a weekly basis?
I think they can do it by opening playing time to position battles. And what I mean by that is I think they have a lot of guys that are like body and like talent, because some of the players that have been recruited highly and been highly touted have not really produced. Guys like Isaiah Bean was a big get for them, and he's currently rotating, but not a lot of production. Charlotte, the transfer, the transfer O-lineman, Baldwin, those guys have not appeared in the game, or they've not affected the game at all thus far. Kyle Mayberry, another one of those guys. So it makes you think maybe those guys aren't practicing as well, and the guys in front of them are earning the reps. However, what I see is what we did when I was in this position in 2003, I was a redshirt, so I didn't play. But our defense had a lot of struggles. We were one of the worst defenses in the country. They tried everyone. They tried everyone at every position until something stuck. The interesting part of that about that was Charles Gordon was the one that stuck. He was a guy that played slot receiver for us, and I think he had 700 or so yards, so a big-time slot receiver. They moved him to corner late in the year out of necessity, and this guy ends up coming in the next year and getting 8 picks. So I would like to see some of those things happen just across the whole defense and across the whole offense. A good example of that was at right tackle with Toby. He was a guy that didn't start the game but subbed in after a few series and held that spot down really well. And he may have been a guy that, you know, doesn't quite grasp the offense as well, doesn't quite practice as well as the guy ahead of him, but with an opportunity to play in the game, he performed.
Brandon McAnderson joining us here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWM. I guess that, like, and I hear, I'm sure you hear it too, people on social media ready to throw in the towel, and I understand the frustrations, but to me, and I've said this several times before, there's a fine line between being frustrated and being disappointing, being disappointed, but yet not giving up on the team, not ready to throw in the towel. And I know that people don't want to hear this, but you got to be able to remember what was inherited 2 years ago and what they came from to where they are now. Maybe you expected them to go out and take care of business against MAC opponents, but to me that's just a very oversimplified view of college football. It doesn't work that way.
It really doesn't. I think that from a fan standpoint, not to, with all due respect to fans, I would use a Mandinoism. You know, we used to sit in our meeting rooms, and we face the same kind of heat that this team faces. And you have to insulate yourself to a point where it doesn't matter, and it never mattered to us. But what he always said was, fan is short for fanatic. So what that does for me is it gives me an understanding of where the fan is coming from and understanding that they have a right to be upset about this product, and they have a right to voice their opinions about it. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that they shouldn't do those things. I mean, it's their right to do those things, and they're invested in the program. But it doesn't make those things true. It doesn't make them false either. You know, with sports and arguments in general, it's a failure to acknowledge that more than one thing could be true. You can acknowledge that the program has made progress and also acknowledge that you feel that the team has underperformed in these first three non-conference games. I mean, that more than one thing could be true. The issue is there's people that have to actually deal with those problems, and they get paid a lot of money, and then there's people that just get on and gripe about it. So, I mean, I guess everybody is performing to their expectations as fans or coaches or whatever your role may be. But I understand it from both perspectives. They are a team that you feel like should be competing at a higher level, and at the same time, this is a team that's made a lot of progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think the secondary and the issues they've had through three games is maybe the best example of that, because last year it wasn't a strength of the team. But you had three seniors starting back there alongside a really talented freshman in Mike Lee. Well, now that freshman, Mike Lee, who technically should be a freshman this year, is playing alongside three guys who had combined for zero starts in D1 college football coming into this season. And you start to look at that as an issue and you say, okay, why is the secondary not as good? Well, it's because this is technically David Beatty's second full recruiting class. And these guys who are playing, while they may have high upside and people are really excited about their potential, they are just freshmen, and they are just sophomores in a lot of cases. And it's just really tough for a guy who inherited a program where the cupboards were almost completely barren when he got here to bring in those recruits and have them also simultaneously show up and be able to compete at a very high level from day one. And that's essentially what's being asked of that secondary.
And it's two parts. The one part is, Fitz Smithson was a really good football player. So that's one part of it. So he, from a communication standpoint, from being able to do multiple things, he was really good. Okay, so he was really, really good. The other part of that is, let's not forget, so at the beginning of the season, so I think it was Texas Tech game, it was Badgy Bates, it was Stewart, and it was, what was that, number 10, what was that corner's name?
Marnez Ogletree?
Ogletree. So those were your three guys. Memphis torched them. I mean, completely torched those guys. I remember looking at Ogletree and thinking, God, I wish his career was over. You know, the fan inside of me. That guy was really good at the end of the season, and so was Brandon Stewart. Brandon Stewart ended up having some key interceptions against Texas that led them to that win. These were the same people. So Kansas stuck with those guys and developed them. I know Kenny Perry is a well-regarded defensive back coach. Ogletree, Stewart, Bazzy Bates, if you'd have watched the film of those first three games, you'd have thought the same thing you feel now, that their defense and secondary was going to be bad and they were going to struggle. And these were by the end of the season, those same players had solidified spots. They had locked down positions. They had made the team more comfortable. And let's not forget, defense is a thing that is about doing your job. And once these guys learn to do their job, some other things will fall in place. The defensive line is complicit in that. The linebackers are complicit in that in the passing game, loosening up zones over the middle. So this is not a matter of four players. This is a matter of 11. And they all have to do their parts. And I think people can overreact to that. But if you look at what they were able to do last year as a staff and developing players that were inexperienced, you got to feel pretty decent about what they were in last year.
And I hope that most fans will be able to understand that and appreciate that and take everything in stride moving forward. But going back to the Mangino-ism, fan is short for fanatics. And as they enter Big 12 play, things aren't going to get any easier. And I don't think anybody's expecting the results to really improve, at least from that secondary, a ton from what we've already seen. And I can just already see it now, like the reaction and the vitriol is just going to get worse and worse as the season moves on. And I think that's just, I think that's too bad. I hope it doesn't get out of hand, but right. I can kind of see it coming.
And then you said part of it too with MAC opponents. So with MAC opponents and the fan base seeing improved players, the coaching staff seeing improved players, the players looking at each other and seeing improved players, this group of men, for the first time in their career, had expectations. This was the first time that they had to play with expectations, being Central Michigan and Ohio. Those were the only games that I can think of recently that they were expected to compete or expected to at least have a chance to win those football games. And I could see it. You could see there were times in each game where there were some heads dropped, and there were some things that when they didn't go right, they kind of looked around like, what's going on? I think that the expectations will be significantly lower for Big 12 play, and I think that'll bring something out of them. And these are young, inexperienced guys. I'm telling you, you can't teach people how to win without winning. So there's no substitute for it. You can't win a scrimmage and say, hey, we're winners. You have to actually win football games. And to win football games, you have to be in football games. So let's not underappreciate these guys having to deal with pressure for the first time.
He's Brandon McAnderson. I'm Nick Schwert, Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. And I've said this several times. I'm curious as to what you think about it, but we've seen it every year. The past 2 years, when the talent was not up to par with what it is this year, teams come into Memorial Stadium, whether it's those early kickoff times, whether it's just they're overlooking or they're having a bad game, things aren't clicking. KU is going to put together some games in which they're able to take care of the football and they get some big plays on defense, right? That's it. That's all you really need to get in a couple of these games. You don't need to completely shut them down defensively. You don't need to be able to put 50 points on the board. But this offense is capable of more than what we've seen over the last 2 years, and they've been in Big 12 play. So I don't know if it's going to happen this weekend, but I know there are going to be a couple games this year where they are absolutely in it and they have a puncher's chance to get out of there with a win at some point in this season.
Absolutely. You're going to see a West Virginia team that is very talented, but they are going to be body clocked on 10 a.m. It's going to be an early kickoff. And this Kansas team is better than the two teams that competed with Oklahoma State in the past. A few years back when they played against Oklahoma State, Tyreek Hill had the kick return for a touchdown that buried Kansas. They had a chance to win that game late. And then Oklahoma State game, I believe, was that last year they hosted Oklahoma State? Or was that two years ago?
Yeah, no, that was last year.
Last year they were in that game for the fourth quarter. And this team's better than that team. They're definitely better on offense, and they definitely have more or as many good contributors on defense. So don't underestimate them not having as many expectations to win that football game, and don't underappreciate they're going to raise their level of play. They are going to prepare. They're going to prepare different, play different, and look different a number of games this year. Hopefully this is one of them.
All right, BMAC, last week in our picks, you went 0-3 in college football. You went 2-3 in the NFL. You are 5-12-1 overall, but I'm not saying that to, like, trying to make some sort of dig at you, because that would just be cheap, and I wouldn't do that to you because you're a friend of mine. But I'm just saying, if people just listen to your picks each week and then just straight up pick whoever you don't pick, they would be making tons of money this year. So I think that's a positive spin on what you've been bringing to the table each Friday.
Right. I'm about advice. You know, if you want advice, come see me. If you want to know who's going to win a football game, don't come see me. You know how many college football games I watch a week? One. I watch Kansas play. College football games are so long. It's either I watch college football or I get a divorce. And I really like my life right now. So I'm going to watch one Kansas football game, and I'm not going to watch another college football game. I'm not doing it, Nick.
Okay, that's fine. With that being said, I'm going to keep giving them to you, and we're going to see if we can't go on some sort of historical run here, because so far it's been unprecedented, not necessarily in the most flattering way, but it is unprecedented nonetheless. So with that being said, no further ado, let's get at it. TCU at Oklahoma State, a great Big 12 opener. The Pokes are 13.5-point favorites at home.
Ooh. Well, they have been virtually unstoppable, but I think TCU is going to be able to slow them down. But I think I'm going to take Oklahoma State to cover.
All right, Mississippi State at Georgia. Georgia is 4.5-point favorites.
Two pretty good teams from what I've heard. Seems like Mississippi State wants to put something together this year. I'm going to take Mississippi State.
And then KU opening Big 12 play against West Virginia. West Virginia coming into town as 21.5-point favorites on the road.
They will not cover.
I like
that. Late game heroics.
I love that. I love the confidence in the Hawks to cover that spread. All right, on to the NFL. Chiefs at Chargers. I guess it's a road game technically, but that's like, what, 30,000-seat stadium in L.A., and the Chargers haven't even come close to selling it out so far, which is, that is a new level of pitiful to have that small of a stadium, and it's going to be a sea of red tomorrow. So the Chiefs are 3-point favorites in what is technically, I think, a pseudo-home game.
Nobody loses close games like San Diego, but they will get over the hump.
No.
This Sunday.
Come on. Oh, come on, man.
They've got two losses by a combined, what is it, 5 points?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Chargers are coming.
All right, Atlanta, 3-point favorites on the road against the Lions.
Lions look tough.
A couple of 2-0 teams there.
Yeah, they're two pretty good. I mean, might be two of the best teams in the NFC. I'm going to take the Falcons.
All right, the Seahawks on the road against Tennessee, a sneaky good game on Sunday. The Titans are 2.5-point favorites.
I'm going to take the Titans. You can't – I mean, people talk about ratings and quarterback play. I do watch NFL games. People talk about ratings and quarterback play. These teams don't have offensive linemen. So I don't care who's playing quarterback and who's playing wide receiver if you get sacked every third down. I'm going to take the Titans.
All right, last one. Your Raiders on the road against Washington, and Oakland is a 3-point favorite.
Of course, we'll cover. No problem.
How – I mean, like – I'm not even going to ask you if the AFC West is the best division in football, because it clearly is, but like, it is on a completely another level than what everything else in the NFL looks like through just 2 weeks of play. But I mean, three teams tied atop the standings, and it's not, none of them are surprising. You don't look at any of those and go, wow, I'm shocked that the Chiefs or the Raiders or the Broncos are 2-0. Like, how confident are you that the AFC West will get three teams into the playoffs this year?
Completely confident. I think it's a testament to, like, continuity. I think they've held their teams together, you know, and added pieces but not made any huge, you know, additions or spent a lot of money to add this guy or that guy. They've gradually built through the draft, and then they've signed free agents here and there to contribute to their team, and they just stayed together. They just kept continuity, kept getting better, and then made some good hires. You know, the Broncos hire is looking like a great hire. Them trusting Simeon, it looks like a great decision. Oakland adding important pieces, and then the Chiefs just having peak Andy Reid right now. Smaller Andy Reid as opposed to fatter Andy Reid. Smaller Andy Reid has been the wizard. I mean, his game plans have been incredible, and now he has an unlimited number of midgets to run all over the field and score touchdowns that are completely blazing fast. So they've been a fun team to watch, to be honest with you.
That's why you come for the breakdowns. He's Brandon McAnderson. Thanks for the time, man.
All right, man. Have a good one.